Danny Elfman is one of the most in-demand and acclaimed composers working in the film industry today. Over the years, his collaborations with the director Tim Burton on movies like Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands proved huge hits with moviegoers and critics alike. On Sunday, December the 8th, one of those collaborations comes to the Three Arena in Dublin. The Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton's 1993 fantasy fairy tale, will be screened live, accompanied by the RTE Concert Orchestra performing the full soundtrack on the night. But what makes this occasion particularly special is that composer Danny Elfman will be part of that performance alongside two other key members of the original movie cast. I'll talk to Danny Elfman about that and much else in a few moments' time. But first of all, let's have a sample of what audiences can expect on December 8th.
Boys and girls of every age, wouldn't you like to see something strange?
Come with us and you will see, this our town of Halloween.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween, pumpkins scream in the dead of night.
This is Halloween, everybody make a scene,
trick or treat, tell the neighbors on the diaphragm.
It's our town, everybody's free.
Ground sharp and eyes glowing red.
I am the one hiding under your stairs. Fingers like snakes and spiders in my hair.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween, 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 Halloween.
In this town we call home, everyone hail to the pumpkin song.
In this town, don't we love it now? Everybody's waiting for the next surprise.
Round that corner man hiding in the trash can. Something's waiting now to pounce and how you'll scream.
This is Halloween.
Red and black.
It's slightly green.
Aren't you scared?
Well, that's just fine.
Say it once, say it twice. Take a chance and roll the dice.
Ride with the moon in the dead of night.
Everybody scream. Everybody scream.
Cloud with the tearaway face.
Here in a flash, gone are the trace.
I am the who in the cold who's there.
I am the wind blowing through your hair.
I am the shadow on the moon at night, filling your dreams to the brim with fright.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween, 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 Halloween.
This is Halloween, the name of the song there, composed by Danny Elfman and taken from the 1993 movie The Nightmare Before Christmas. Danny Elfman joins me on the line now from Los Angeles ahead of his Dublin concert on December the 8th, where that movie will be screened. You know, I suppose, Danny Elfman, it has to be Tim Burton who will put Halloween right up beside Christmas. Only he could do that.
Yeah, well, definitely. And that actually fits really well with my way of thinking as well.
Is that why you've been such great collaborators? And I suppose, I presume you've become friends as well as colleagues over the years. Do you think very similarly?
Well, it's hard to say. Tim has a really unique and unusual mind. So I can't say, yes, I think the same as him. But I could just say that his way of viewing the world and his aesthetic seems very simple and natural for me. So it was never like a struggle to kind of find that place, because we kind of grew up similarly and same monster horror background. You know, we were definitely Halloween kids, monster kids.
You know, when I listen to that This Is Halloween song, and in fact, when I listen to lots of the music you have composed for Tim Burton movies, I said, that's the sound of a Tim Burton movie. To what extent are you always reacting to visuals, or in some cases, are you simply reacting to a conversation you've had with Tim?
Well, it's usually visuals, because Tim doesn't like to discuss the movies a lot. So when we start out, we'll look at the movie, and he might just say a few things one way or another, but he's not going to give me a lot of verbal stuff to go on. It's really, he's not going to have much to say until he hears music, and then he'll have an opinion. It's like, oh yeah, that's what I was thinking, or can it be a little more like this? And so it's really the visuals and just the sensibility of it that I'm usually reacting to.
But in the case of Nightmare Before Christmas, of course, not only were you composing there, but you were involved in terms of your own voice and Jack Skellington, which is something that you're going to give us when you come to Dublin. This is a Halloween town. Halloween Town is the setting for the film. The Pumpkin King is what you'll be giving us.
Yes. The creation was really unique because Tim came to me about it, but neither of us really knew how you start an animated musical. And so we kind of mucked about with different ideas and then realized that the director, Henry Selick, had already put a studio together in Northern California, and there was no script. And so we were like, let's just start with the songs. Okay, sure, why not? We'll do it backwards. We'll start with the songs, and then the script will follow. And he just started showing me pictures, because he had all these great drawings of the characters. And he would show me these drawings, and then he would tell me part of the story. And as he's telling me the story, I'm hearing the song in my head. And we just, bang, three days per song, 30 days, finished the whole thing. It was just a kind of one of those things. It just clicked so easily.
Was there a poem originally that Tim Burton had as well that had kind of had inspired the story here?
Yeah. He had kind of a rough thing that he had done. And I think that's why it happened. I think what it is I don't know the exact story, but I think Disney kind of realized, wait a minute, we have this early Tim Burton kind of rough project here with these sketched out characters. Let's grab hold of this and do it. And I think that's how it came about, because I think it's something he'd created when he was very young as an animator at Disney.
How well did yourself and Tim know each other at this point? You'd worked on a few projects together at this stage. I suppose we go back to the 1980s and Beetlejuice, but you'd done a few films together at this point.
Well, yeah, I mean, it all started in 1985 with Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And that's when I met Tim. He'd done Pee-wee, and it was just a kind of a random thing. Pee-wee, whose name is Paul Rubens, he knew of my work through a kind of a cult midnight film I'd done for my brother called The Forbidden Zone, and he really loved that. And Tim knew me through my band, which was called Oingo Boingo, and he used to come see my band. And when he called me in for a meeting on Pee-wee, I assumed he was looking for a song, because, you know, I was doing some songs for movies. And he said, no, I'd like a whole score. And I was like, me? Why me? And he showed me some, and I went and wrote a little piece of music and recorded it on my little 4-track tape recorder and sent him a cassette tape. And the next thing I knew, I was hired to do Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yeah, Pee-wee's Big Adventure then was essentially the first film score. Now, I know you mentioned that you had done The Forbidden Zone for your brother.
Well, the Forbidden Zone was more like with this theater troupe. So my first time actually writing down music, and definitely my first time with an orchestra ever in my life, was Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Had you any sense, you know, when that happened then? Was there even a sense when you heard the music being realised by the orchestra and seeing it being matched up with the visuals? Had you any sense, I've arrived home. This is what I should be doing. This is the direction. This is where I'm going for the rest of my life.
Well, let me put it this way. Definitely it got under my skin. It was like, it was the first cue. I'd never been in front of an orchestra before. And hearing that orchestra up close for that first cue in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, the bicycle race, it really like, wow, this is pretty cool. I think I could kind of get into this. So I did decide that, yeah, I like this, but I probably won't get any more. You know, you have to realize I expected the score to Pee-wee's Big Adventure to be thrown out. It was such a weird score. And I thought for sure that the film studio would hear it and just toss it and then hire a proper composer to come in and write a proper score. So I was surprised it even made it into the film. But it ended up being one of those incredibly lucky moments, because it was at a time when I don't think people knew quite what to do with music in film comedies, especially a quirky comedy. Film music was in a weird place there in the mid-80s, and Pee-wee's Big Adventure just came along at the right place at the right time. It was a lucky break, because immediately I was just offered every quirky comedy made in Hollywood. It was kind of funny, because I considered myself a pretty dark guy, but here I was being offered all these like up-tempo, happy, quirky comedies. So it kind of opened up these doors. So I had to really push myself at that point. It's like, all right, I'm going to keep doing films as best I can, along with being in the band. I'll try to squeeze one or two in a year, but I've got to force myself to really, really expand my skills. So I started teaching myself, really training hard with every film I got to try to kind of improve my skills as best I could. And I was doing this at the same time while I was touring and writing and recording with my band. So it was pretty crazy. I had 10 years where I was doing both. I don't think I ever worked less than 16 hours a day. I mean, it was pretty crazy.
All right, so there were some great film scores, there's no question about that. But there was also this piece of music. You know, I hear that particular sequence of music, Danny Elfman, and immediately I see Bart and the Simpson family making their way back to the sofa a la Flintstones. What visuals had you seen when you composed the theme tune for The Simpsons?
Well, I mean, this was another case of a super lucky break of something that I never expected anybody to hear. You know, I got called into this meeting and they showed me a pencil sketch of the opening. So it really was the opening sequence, but just not in color and not rendered. It was more like moving pencil sketchy kind of version, but it was all there, the beginning of The Simpsons. And I told Matt my take on the energy of it was like crazy Hanna-Barbera retro feel, because it reminded me a little bit of the Flintstones kind of energy. And so I said, you know, if you want something modern for this one, I'm probably not the guy, but if you want something crazy retro, I got something in my head, and I think, you know, that's where I would go. And Matt Groening said, yeah, that sounds good to me. So once again, it was one of these things where, even more than Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I mean, this one was crazy because I wrote it in my head in the car on the way home. I mean, by the time I got home from that meeting, it was done. And I ran down to my studio, made sure I didn't listen to any other music that was going to erase it. And again, I pulled out my four-track tape recorder, played all the parts, spent about a couple hours. I knew it, you know, every note of it. I just had to play them all. I learned at that point never to go anywhere without, I was a little Sony kind of a tape recorder Walkman. And because first off, I knew that anytime I'm on an airplane or in a car, that's where I'm going to get ideas. Anytime when I'm not where I could do anything about it. So I never left home without a tape recorder. And so all the way home, I'm like singing. You know, so I'm hearing the whole thing and I'm singing all these different parts. I must have like 10, 12 entries on this tape. But I didn't, when I got to my house, I didn't need to refer to it because it was still clear in my head. But that was an insurance policy that if a car pulled up next to me and was playing a Beatles song or something, or some other catchy tune, that it might erase everything. And that's why I had to have some kind of audio notes. I learned the hard way, you know, those are the ones that got away, so to speak. And it was that immediate and quick. And I sent the tape back to Matt Groening, and he called me later that day and he goes, yep, that's it. And off we go. And that was it.
Just one further question on The Simpsons. Did Lisa have a saxophone in those squiggly pencil pictures that you saw, or did you put the saxophone into somebody's mouth?
No. There was a saxophone, and the idea was from the get-go to have a bad saxophone solo play. So in the very first version, I was like, kind of like, okay, trying to explain to the orchestra, you know, there was a sax player, so we just got to do this separately because you got to play really bad. And it's always kind of rough for like a really, really good musician to do something that plays sounds really bad. So I kind of took him on his own, and we played it 3 or 4 times. And I said, "Worse, worse, play it worse." And finally, he got it. He go, "Yep, that'll do it."
I'm just, you know, when you look at the credit, your film credits, Danny Elfman. I mean, I could just, if I wanted a 20-minute interview, I could read all your credits out, and I probably wouldn't have them finished by the end of the 20 minutes. But I'm looking at 50 Shades of Grey, Sam Taylor Johnson, 2015, Men in Black in 1997, Good Will Hunting with Gus Van Sant directing, of course, in 1997, and Dolores Claiborne, directed by Taylor Hackford in 1995. Particularly that, I like the Vera theme from within Dolores Claiborne. Vera's World. Do you have a memory of that particular track or that theme and how it came to you?
I don't. I'd have to like listen to it to remember it because it's been so long. You know, I never listen to my own work after I've done it. You know, unless I'm doing a concert. Really, I didn't listen to any of my work with Tim Burton until I started to organize this show for Albert Hall, where we did the, you know, Elfman Burton did these suites, and I was like going back and listening to everything. And but it's funny. It's like if I heard it, I'd recognize it right away. But after 100 film scores, it's like...
Yeah, which one is it? Can you bear to take 30 seconds of it now? And just to remind you, just to prick up the ears, perhaps?
Yes.
Can I give you that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go.
Sure.
So you hear that though, that piano figure, you hear the pizzicato strings coming in. Does a memory come back to you, Danny?
Sure. I mean, what was I thinking? I don't know. It was just a mood. There was a tone. You know, everything in every movie, no matter what it is finding the tone, capturing the tone. Like, what is the feel of this movie? And Dolores Claiborne was heaven for me because I'd been doing so many comedic, quirky things. And to be able to write something, you know, there was a few scores in that time, Black Beauty, Dolores Claiborne, where I could just write either kind of a little more dissonantly, certainly Good Will Hunting, Milk that came along after that. You know, it's like, it's such a relief for me to be able to just write almost closer to how I might be just doing a composition on my own and to write something that's not needing to get quirky or nutty or crazy or frenetic, because that part of me is definitely there all the time, but I don't get to express it as often. So Dolores Claiborne, it was a wonderful experience for me because I just felt like I could really just open up and go and let out this music that I hadn't been able to do.
You've cited Danny Bernard Herrmann as something of an inspiration for you. I mean, a big collaborator there, obviously, with Alfred Hitchcock, but music for Taxi Driver, music for Psycho, in the case of an Alfred Hitchcock movie, and several others as well. What is it about Herrmann's composition for film? When you realised that film scoring and scoring writing, composing scores for film was going to become a big part of your career, what was it about Herrmann's way of approaching things, or what he did that attracted you?
Well, I mean, Herrmann was the one that made me aware of film music. I think I was 12 when I heard the score to, I saw the movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And I remember suddenly being moved by the music and being aware that there was a name that went with the music. And up to that point, I never paid attention to that. There was just music in movies. So suddenly there was this name, and I listened, you know, hard, because I saw the movie like 2-3 times, and each time the music was so wonderful. And so as other movies came up back when I was a kid and I saw his name, it would be like, oh, there he is again, Herrmann. And I was also, you know, a big fan of fantasy, science fiction, and horror films. So I grew up on a lot of the films he did with the Ray Harryhausen stop motion animation, Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts. And so these were the movies I grew up on, and they all had these wonderfully inventive scores. And then to go on as a teenager and then discover Hitchcock going backwards in time, my mom would not let me go see Psycho. It was the first and only movie of my life I was not allowed to see as a kid. Because unlike the way it is today, when we were kids growing up, our parents never even knew what movies we were seeing. I mean, we just went out to the movies every weekend and we just saw what we saw. And suddenly there was this Psycho and I couldn't wait. My mom said, no, you're not going. We had this huge fight over it. So I didn't get to hear Herman's collaboration with Hitchcock until a little later, because the first Hitchcock I saw was The Birds, which had no score at all. So then I discover Hitchcock and I'm going, here he is again, Herman. So first through science fiction and fantasy, and then through the incredible scores he did for Hitchcock, North by Northwest, Vertigo, Psycho. And Psycho, for me, is still, I think, my number one film score ever. And it was the inventiveness of the sound. It was the orchestration, the way he used instruments. But mainly, the lesson I learned from Herman was that the main rule of film composing is that there are no rules. What he did and how he did it sounded unique and different than other film scores, and in a way that didn't seem generic or obvious at all. And that stuck with me, that you could do kind of anything and let your personality out to create a film score. So, but it left me a desire to try to make my film scores recognizable, to try to do something, to put something in the score that had me in it and had the film in it uniquely. So if you heard it later, you'd go, oh, that's the score to such and such a film. And that's what Herman brought to his films. Whereas other films, I would listen to them and I would go, oh, it's a nice score. I have no idea who did it because it sounds like a lot of other nice scores. So I haven't always been able to achieve that, but that's always been my goal. And it certainly was my goal as I began.
Let's come back then to the project that's coming to Dublin just as we finish up now. Sunday, the December the 8th, which will see this performance of The Nightmare Before Christmas. The RT Concert Orchestra will be conducted by John McCherry. But part of the cast, you'll be there yourself, you know, reprising your role.
Yeah.
And also with you will be Catherine O'Hara as Sally. Probably, I suppose, most people will know her as Macaulay Culkin's mother in Home Alone. And Ken Page. Ken Page is the voice of Oogie Boogie. How nice is it to actually get a chance? You know, you don't often get that, to actually reprise something with the original cast members, essentially.
Well, that's kind of why I'm doing it. I think if they weren't going to come on board for it, I wouldn't have done it either. It's down to that. You know, I don't do it a lot, the Nightmare shows, but when I do it, I really like to do it with them. It just makes it special for me. It really does.
Does performing in your own music, is that different from hearing it? Because when you were saying that you don't listen to your own music, you listen back to your own stuff, I'm wondering, does he watch films then with the volume turned down? How does he manage it? It must be very difficult to watch a film that you've composed for if you don't like listening.
Yeah, it's weird. My wife is an actress, and so if either of our films come on, we kind of have a deal with each other. The other one's allowed to skip it to another channel. It's kind of a mutual thing in my family. But, you know, Nightmare was a real special project for me. It came together really, I don't know how to explain it, really simply and beautifully with Tim. We didn't know how to begin an animated musical. There's no kind of rule book. And the only thing that I knew going into it, which Tim was in agreement with, is that we didn't want it to sound like a Broadway musical. And I didn't want it to sound like a Disney musical. So I knew what it didn't want it to be, but we didn't know what we wanted it to be. So we just really started, even without a script. He had the storyline and he had all these fantastic drawings of all the characters. And he would just take out the drawings and show them to me and say, just tell me a little bit about the story. And I said, just pretend you're telling like a bedside story. And he would say, okay, well, Jack is wandering through the forest and he comes to these trees and he sees there's three doors. And he would just tell me the story. And as he's telling the story, I would start hearing the song in my head. And I would go, okay, that's it. Leave, quick. And I would go in the other room and I would write the song. And 3 days later, I would call him up and say, here it is. And he'd come over, listen to it. He goes, oh, great. Okay, now Jack is da-da-da-da-da. And so we just put it together that way until we realized, wow, there's like 10 songs. Is that too many? Yeah, we don't know. Who cares? It's like we're not following the template of a Disney musical anyhow, so we shouldn't worry about that. And so much of the story was told in song just because that's how we started. We didn't really know how to start.
Any memory of what he told you about Oogie Boogie?
He had these great drawings of Oogie Boogie, and I immediately thought of Cab Calloway. And Tim knew that, you know, I used to be in a band that played a lot of Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway, and that I loved Cab. So Oogie Boogie song was kind of a loving tribute to Cab Calloway, and he was on board for that. So I kind of wrote it with that in mind.
Well, let's finish up by listening to Ken Page as the voice of Oogie Boogie. And Danny Elfman, real pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for speaking to us tonight.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I can't wait to get out there and do this show. It's really going to be fun. I'm chomping at the bit, ready to go.